From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we join the Zapatista caravan in Morelia, Michoacan, and check on their progress from Chiapas to Mexico City. Then, who bankrolled the Bush administration and what do they expect in return? The Bush administration says it'll stop bombing Vieques for now. What does it mean? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Navy today begins a rare court of inquiry into the actions and events that led a nuclear-powered submarine to smash into a Japanese fishing boat, killing 9 people, including 4 high school students learning to fish. Over the weekend, news broke that the submarine had left port that day solely to take a group of 16 civilians for a ride. The captain of the submarine had canceled a longer training exercise, but still took the submarine out for a day trip to accommodate the high-profile guests, many of whom are major campaign contributors. Investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board and a preliminary inquiry by a Navy commander have found that the presence of the civilians, including 2 who occupied control positions when the Greenville surfaced abruptly, proved a distraction to the crew. And this interesting bit of history. On August 7th, 1995, a day after Hiroshima Day anniversary, 4 religious peace activists, calling themselves the Jubilee Plowshares East, carried out an act of nonviolent disarmament on the USS Greenville at Newport News, Virginia shipbuilding. They hammered on the USS Greenville, protesting the nuclear fast attack submarine, and were charged by the state with trespass and destruction of property. In the aftermath of a Palestinian suicide bombing which killed 3 Israelis, Ariel Sharon has sealed a coalition for a government that he vows will bring security. Incoming Prime Minister Sharon won an agreement late yesterday from the ultra-Orthodox Shas party to join his government, securing him a majority in parliament. Shas officials said they decided to wrap up coalition negotiations quickly because of the, quote, deteriorating security situation. That paves way for him to submit to parliament this week a government that includes 2 far-right parties as well as the Labour Party. Yesterday, a Palestinian bomber blew himself up and killed 3 Israelis at a bustling intersection in the coastal town of Netanya in the second lethal explosion in 4 days. It follows 2 days of clashes in the West Bank and Gaza in which Israeli soldiers involved in firefights shot dead 6 Palestinians, including a 9-year-old boy and a 43-year-old woman out walking with her husband and children on Saturday. A legal dispute with far-reaching consequences for AIDS prevention in developing countries has begun in the South African capital of Pretoria. Multinational pharmaceutical companies are challenging a proposed new law which would allow South Africa to import medicines from the cheapest source, perhaps India or Brazil, and so give far greater access to drugs. The government says that under existing arrangements, it cannot afford the drugs it desperately needs to combat AIDS and other diseases. The 39 companies, including Glaxo, Wellcome, and Merck, say the government's plan would threaten their patent rights. Several hundred protesters gathered in Pretoria as the hearing began, carrying placards with slogans like AIDS profiteers deadlier than the virus and free treatment for all. In South Africa, 250,000 people died from AIDS last year, and 1 in 10 of the population is believed to be HIV positive. Russia's foreign ministry said today it summoned a U.S. diplomat to demand an explanation for reports that intelligence services had dug a tunnel under the Soviet embassy in Washington during the 1980s. Reports in the U.S. press over the weekend said the plan to dig the tunnel to monitor communications in the Washington embassy was betrayed by FBI agent Robert Hansen, arrested last month on charges of spying for the Soviet Union and Russia. A ministry statement said if proved true, the reports would amount to a blatant violation of recognized norms of international law valid throughout the world in relation to diplomatic representations. A Russian ambassador to Washington said diplomats were aware of being observed. He said the incident was hypocritical, as the United States was complaining throughout the 1980s that its Moscow embassy had been bugged. A federal appeals court struck down a set of regulations on Friday that had prevented the nation's largest cable companies from growing larger and broadcasting more of their own shows. The panel found the rules had violated the company's First Amendment rights to reach new audiences and to control their programming. The decision is a tremendous victory for AT&T and AOL Time Warner, the nation's two largest cable operators, which have spent years trying to get regulators, lawmakers, and judges to overturn the rules known as cable concentration caps. The rules have prevented any one cable company from serving more than 30% of the cable and satellite market subscribers and from providing more than 40% of its channels with programming from its affiliated companies. Consumer groups criticized the decision, saying it would reduce competition in an industry already marked by consolidation, limited subscriber choices, and prices that have risen far faster than inflation.
The circles of the atoms all play the marching tune, and we who would join it stand aside no longer. Now let us all begin. We can't stand aside no longer. Now let us all begin.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to look at the Zapatista caravan that has been making its way from Chiapas to Mexico City. This weekend, on its seventh day, the Zapatista bus caravan arrived in Nurio, Mexico, to attend the National Indigenous Congress. At the open-air event, Indians from across Mexico are debating a variety of issues, including the often ignored rights of women, to the role Zapatista rebels should play in their movement. The women voted to have male-female couples represent the Congress at all levels, and the Congress talked about how to create the first truly national movement and whether the Zapatistas should lead it. Since taking office December 1st, Mexican President Vicente Fox has closed four army bases in Chiapas and said he wants to make peace with the rebels a priority. Fox sent Congress a bill on Indian rights and autonomy and helped gain the release of dozens of jailed Zapatista supporters with his introduction of a joint program with telecommunications giant Telmex to provide bail bonds to indigenous activists in state prisons. But rebels say that in addition to passage of the rights bill, all prisoners must be released and three more military bases must be closed. Among the votes taken at the Indigenous Congress, the estimated 5,000 Indians and political activists proposed forming a human chain around Mexico's Congress until the rights bill is passed. The caravan is scheduled to reach Mexico City on March 11th. We're going to try to reach the Zapatista caravan as we've been making contact on and off throughout the morning. Today also, we're going to talk about who bought Bush. The Mother Jones 400 reveals who bankrolled the new administration and what they expect as payback. And we're also going to go to Puerto Rico to hear reaction to the Bush administration's decision, specifically the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's announcement that the U.S. administration would stop bombing Vieques, at least for now. But right now, it looks like we have made contact in Morelia, Michoacan, with Tim Russo. He is a reporter, Mexico reporter, for community station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, where I'm looking forward to seeing people this weekend at a conference that's taking place on globalization at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Tim Russo is now in Morelia, Michoacan, on one of the buses. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Oh, amazing connection. First, can you start off by laying out for us, before you introduce some of the guests we'll have on, what this caravan is about?
Yeah, the Zapatista National Liberation Army, on the 2nd of December, the day after President Vicente Fox was inaugurated, held a press conference in La Realidad, in their headquarters in Chiapas, in the Lacandon jungle. They announced at that time, during that press conference, that what they would do is they would form a caravan and send a delegation of their general leadership, their general command, entailing 23 Zapatista leaders and Subcomandante Marcos, the spokesperson for the Zapatistas. The idea behind this was to have a march, a delegation, a caravan that would go towards Mexico City with two purposes. One, to come to Nurillo, Michoacán, where we just left this morning, and participate in the 3rd National Indigenous Congress, where they could really build up support for the main reason for the trip, to go into Mexico City, have a meeting with Congress, the National Congress, and push through the partial peace accords that were signed between the EZLN, the Zapatistas, and the Congressional Intermediary Team and the government in 1996, in February. Those are the COPPA agreements, and what they specifically talk about is indigenous culture and rights. So they've been trying to galvanize that support and push that through right now. They'll arrive in Mexico on the 11th and go to Congress shortly thereafter, trying to push through those indigenous laws.
So describe where you are right now.
Right now we're in the center of Morelia, the capital of Michoacán, and we're awaiting the rest of the delegation to come in. The delegation right now consists of the main bus that has the Zapatista leadership on it, and then probably about 50 or more Pullman buses carrying civil society from within Mexico and internationals. Many people from Italy, Spain, U.S., Argentina, all over the world have come to participate and accompany the Zapatistas on their trip. We're about 7 days into the trip right now, and it's about halfway there. We arrive into Mexico City on the 11th in the morning time.
Can you tell us who you're with right now?
Right now I'm with three people, Carlos Efraín, who is a Mije Indian from Oaxaca, who's been working on a video project in Chiapas, based in the communities in Aguas Calientes, who are the centers of resistance in the Zapatista territory for about the last 3 years. With Luz Aida Ruiz, who is a freelance journalist and works in human rights from Tijuana. She's worked quite a bit in and around and covering the maquiladoras in Tijuana. And then also with Amaranta Cornejo, who's from Puebla and has been working with a Mexican volunteer organization that coordinates Mexican volunteers to come and work in San Cristobal de las Casas and the indigenous communities and resistance in Chiapas. She's been in Chiapas for about the last 5 years.
If we could start off by talking with that last guest, Amaran, to talk about the organizing that has been going on in San Cristobal de las Casas, bringing Mexicans in from around the country to Chiapas.
Okay. I'll pass you off to Amaranta right now.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Amaranta. This is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! As we continue our coverage of the March of the Zapatistas to Mexico City, can you explain the work that you've been doing? Why bring Mexicans from outside San Cristobal to Chiapas?
Well, the thing is that there are many things going on in Chiapas, and the rest of the nation knows that there's something going on down there, but they don't know exactly what is it. They have many prejudices, the media is so co-opted. And so we think that it is necessary that the people go down there to Chiapas and see by their eyes what is going on, and also that they can do something, that they can work and not only help, but that they can learn something. That it's one of the most important things, that after 2 years we have saw that the people that has been there, they go back to their places and they feel that they know something more. Not that they have done something, but that they have learned something.
And what kind of work do the Mexican volunteers do in San Cristobal?
Well, they don't work exactly in San Cristobal. They work in the indigenous communities. It depends on the person. If there is an student of medicine, so to say, well, then that person goes to a project involving the health issues. Or if they know something of technology, like potable water or something like that, well, they can go there. It depends on the on their capacities and their interests. So we look for something that is more appropriate to that person.
If you can hand the phone now to the person who is standing next to you and introduce him.
Sorry?
Can you hand the phone now to the person you're standing with so we can get a sense of the people on this trip?
So, like, Lusaira, no?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, hi.
Hi. Can you identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Lusaida Ruiz. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm living in San Cristobal de las Casas right now for the past month.
And can you tell us why you're on the trip of the Zapatistas from Chiapas to Mexico City?
Well, I'm currently helping out with Indie Media Chiapas, covering all of the events during the caravan. So basically that's why I'm joining the caravan.
Now, you are from Tijuana originally?
Yes.
Covering maquiladoras?
Yes, I've worked a bit doing some photo documentaries on the maquiladora movement over there.
And how do maquiladoras, the factories along the border, relate to the indigenous people of Chiapas?
Well, it's very related, maybe not exactly with the indigenous people, since the maquiladora movement is something from the city, very urban, but it's vinculated with the Zapatista movement in that it's sort of a war against capitalism, against an oppressor. So that's how I see it.
Lusaida Ruiz, again, who is on the trip, a filmmaker from Tijuana. You're standing with another man who is from Chiapas, is that right?
Yes.
His name?
His name is Juan Carlos. Okay, he's right here.
And we...
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Hi. We have a translator with us here in the studio. Juana Ponce de León is the editor of Our Word is Our Weapon, which is... the book of Subcomandante Marcos's writings. Could you ask Juan Carlos where he's from and why he's chosen to take this trip, Juana?
Juan Carlos, buenos días.
Buenos días.
Buenos días. Preguntan aquí que de dónde vienes y por qué te has juntado a la caravana zapatista.
Bueno, yo soy de una comunidad indígena en el estado de Oaxaca, el pueblo Mije. He estado trabajando durante años en crear un medio de comunicación comunitario donde nuestros pueblos puedan tener acceso a dar su voz, y ahora me he integrado a la caravana porque también en Chiapas estoy apoyando un poco la construcción de un medio de comunicación autónomo y un medio de comunicación que pueda pues transmitir por medio de la gente de las mismas comunidades qué es lo que está pasando en esta caravana.
Bueno, un minutico, voy a hacer una pequeña traducción con eso. Nuestros oyentes aquí saben qué estás diciendo. Juan Carlos is from Mije, an autonomous community in Oaxaca, and he, you know, has joined the Zapatista caravan because they are wanting to help create, you know, an indigenous, autonomous, free communications. Mm-hmm. And so they're just joining their voice, of the indigenous community is joining their voice to the caravan, and that's why they're there. They're forming part of this.
It has been 7 years since the Zapatista uprising. What difference has it made in your community, Juan Carlos?
Preguntan que ya llevamos 7 años desde el levantamiento zapatista y qué diferencia ha hecho en su propia comunidad. Juan Carlos.
Mira, el movimiento zapatista ha sido muy importante para los pueblos indígenas. Nos ha enseñado bastante a organizarnos y encontrar estrategias para desarrollar y fortalecer nuestras prácticas autónomas. Y también, bueno, la discusión en torno al reconocimiento de la libre determinación de los pueblos indígenas, pues ha sido una de las prácticas más importantes que se han venido fortaleciendo desde la aparición del movimiento zapatista, aunque la situación de represión que ha desarrollado el gobierno sigue latente. Podríamos decir que en muchas de las comunidades la presencia militar y la presencia represoria de parte del gobierno se ha incrementado.
Ajá. Bueno, un minutico. Entonces, what Juan Carlos says is that the Zapatista movement has been very important because it has given them strategies on how to develop within their communities, a stance, to become autonomous. He also says that because of the Zapatista movement, the government has taken a stronger position towards the indigenous communities, and that even though now there is a yielding somewhat, it's still latent there. You don't know. So on the one hand, it has given them strategies. On the other hand, it has created more of a confrontation, one might say, with the government.
And what kind of reception have you gotten from people along the way as you make your way to Mexico City, Juan Carlos?
Juan Carlos, ¿quieren saber qué clase de recepción ha recibido la caravana en el viaje hasta ahora?
Bueno, ha sido increíble la recepción que le ha dado la gente, la gente de los pueblos indígenas, la gente mestiza, por el paso en los diferentes estados, en los diferentes lugares donde se han presentado, pero algo que para mí ha sido como muy emotivo ha sido que mucha de esta gente llega para compartir con ellos el esfuerzo que están desarrollando en sus comunidades, la lucha que están desarrollando, y llegan con ellos para poder hablar de la manera en que están luchando en sus comunidades por fortalecer su autonomía. Ajá. También escuchar mucho de ellos trabajo que están haciendo en su estado.
Bueno, a ver, what Juan Carlos says is that the reception by the people as the caravan goes through has been amazing, but one of the more important things that has been taking place is that as they come through the different communities, people have come to share their own efforts, in the communities, and basically, they share information and they take away, I guess some sort of notions about what, how the Zapatistas are doing their thing. It's like it seems like it's a solidifying and solidarity type of movement.
Well, we're going to continue this march to cover the march over the next 2 weeks as we lead into the meetings that will take place in Mexico City. I want to thank all of our guests, Juan Carlos of Mije, Luceida Ruiz, a filmmaker from Tijuana, who has joined the caravan, and Amaranta Cornejo from Puebla, who has worked with an NGO in Chiapas for the last 4 years, bringing Mexican volunteers to Chiapas, and Tim Russo, the Mexico correspondent for KGNU of Boulder, also on this trip. We will reach people in different buses along the way to find out what their expectations are and what they're finding on their trip. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Also thanks to Juana Ponce de Leon, who's the translator from Seven Stories Press, editor of Our Word is Our Weapon, a new book out on Subcomandante Marcos. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. top revelations about Clinton's dispensation of pardons to wealthy contributors brings home yet again that old political truism: you may not be able to fight City Hall, but you sure can buy a piece of it. In the last cycle, a record $3 billion was donated to federal elections. Wealthy individuals, often representing clear corporate interests, gave large sums to the candidate of their choice, and sometimes just to cover their bets, to both candidates of their choice. This month's web and print versions of Mother Jones Magazine list the top 400 contributors, tells who they gave money to, and what they expect in return. We're going to begin with Roger Cohen, who is the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones Magazine. Okay, who bought Bush?
Well, Terry, of that $3 billion that you mentioned that was poured into the last election campaign over the two-year cycle of 99 and 2000, $646 million of that went to Bush and GOP candidates from corporations and wealthy executives and their families. That's outside of the soft money and other forms of giving. And that was the majority of the $3 billion actually in total went to Bush and the GOP candidates. We have been doing the Mother Jones 400 now. This is the fourth time we've done this list of the 400 largest campaign contributors. And this time what we tried to do was break down the contributions by industry category, tracing not only the 400 donors but and their families and what they contributed, but also what industries they came from. We broke that into 10 industries ranging from finance and communications and high tech to energy and health and other areas as well.
I was interested to see that the top contributor, no lightweight, S. Daniel Abraham, who is the former chair of Slim Fast Foods.
Yes.
$1.5 million.
Yeah, $1.5 million. He's the new number one. He and gave primarily to the Democrats. I mean, one of the things that comes out of the Mother Jones list is that the Democrats do rely on wealthy individuals. As it turns out, most of the people on the list, as has been true in the past, gave primarily to the Democrats. But in total amounts of money, in terms of individual donors. The Republicans, of course, rely more on corporate giving. So that's one of the concerns about any campaign finance reform. That corporate giving, if corporate giving is not controlled, and if only individual donations are controlled, that, of course, helps the Republicans.
And then the number two you've got is Bernard Schwartz, who became well known for the controversy around Loral Space and Communications, CEO of Loral Space and Communications, and selling satellites to the Chinese. He gave $1.3 million. Then you've got Vio Inc. at around the same amount.
Interesting one on that, Amy. Davide Gilo, who is the chairman of Vio Inc., gave $1.3 million, nearly $1 million of that came in last-minute gifts in the very last week of the before the election, which catapulted him into the number three spot on the Mother Jones list.
How do you see this tying in to the Rich pardon, that is the presidential pardon of Mark Rich, the billionaire financier fugitive in Switzerland?
Well, we've got the list on our website, motherjones.com. You just click in, and when you click in for Denise Rich, you find that she is now at number 74 on the list, having given $391,000 to the Democrats, which was a substantial increase from her $116,000 she gave in 1998. She also gave two $1,000 contributions to Hillary Clinton, as well as all the to the Democrats nationally. But we're talking, Terry, of these 400 individuals, a total of $123 million was contributed by these 400 individuals, which was a huge increase over the $36 million that was that the 400 people on our 1998 list gave. Now, 1998, we only measured 18 months. This year, we measured 2 years. This year, we measured 2 years of giving, but still proportionately from 36 million to 123 million, it gives a pretty good picture of how obscene the level of giving by these wealthy individuals has gotten.
In addition to Roger Cohen, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, we're joined by Ken Silverstein and Sarah Miles. Ken Silverstein, a well-known investigative reporter based in Washington, D.C., took a look at the finance sector, and Sarah Miles looked at how to hack a party line, the Democratic Party in Silicon Valley, the high-tech sector. Let's begin with Ken Silverstein. One of George Bush's earliest initiatives is Social Security reform. How active in the elections were the financial institutions that are advocating diverting Social Security money to private investments?
Well, given the amount of money that these people gave and how active they were, let's just say I'm not surprised that this is one of his first initiatives. I mean, the finance sector was one of the most generous. 71 of the 400 names on the Mother Jones 400 are either security brokers or investment managers. And these people gave, these 71 people gave about $19 million, about, I don't know, 55 or slightly higher percent of that went to the GOP. The Democrats also did quite well, which isn't really surprising either because the Clinton-Gore administration was quite friendly to Wall Street, as I'm sure many of your listeners know. I mean, you had the free trade agreements that Wall Street wanted, cuts in capital gains tax, all sorts of initiatives taken by Clinton-Gore. But the majority of the money did go to the GOP, and I think that's in large measure due to Bush's plan to for a partial privatization of Social Security. I mean, this is going to be a gold mine for Wall Street if it goes through. If your listeners aren't aware of his proposal, Bush has said that he would like to divert 2% of Social Security taxes into private accounts, so that instead of, you know, Ken Silverstein, instead of having all of that Social Security tax go to the Social Security fund, 2% will go to me, and I will go down to my brokerage house or my bank and buy into stocks and mutual funds and bonds or whatever I want to do with the money. And the problem here is that, A, the cost of that system, of a privatized system, are much, much higher. The Social Security system is actually administered quite efficiently. The cost of a private system would be much higher. Dean Baker, who is a well-known economist in Washington, and he's at the Center for Economic and Policy Research now, has said that the cost of the semi-privatized system is going to come to about $10 billion annually by 2010, and most of that $10 billion is going to be in the form of fees and commissions for bankers and stockbrokers. So, of course, you know, if Ken Silverstein, instead of putting the money into Social Security, goes down to Charles Schwab, who happens to be one of the big donors to Bush, which I'll get to in a second, Schwab is going to make a commission on my purchase of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. So it's a lot of money that would be funneled over to Wall Street.
So let's talk about Charles Schwab, also Dan Cook of Goldman Sachs, and Richard Gilder, the stockbroker, and what they've been doing, how they connect to this.
Yeah, these are three of the biggest donors from the finance sector, and all of them have been lobbying quite aggressively for this semi-privatized system that their political friend George Bush is now promising to implement. Schwab, of course, heads the Charles Schwab brokerage firm, and it's the biggest brokerage firm in the country. And he has been lobbying for this for some time. He held a series of investor forums on the topic. He wrote a number of op-eds on a private Social Security system. It's one of his chief priorities. Cook is with Goldman Sachs down in Dallas, and he's a buddy of Bush, apparently, a good old boy from Texas. He is a major donor, and he sits on the board of a think tank, which is called the National Center for Policy. It's based in Dallas. It also has Washington offices. And they lobbied very aggressively for the Bush initiative. And right before one of the debates last year between Gore and Bush, they kicked off this big nationwide advertising campaign that touted the benefits of privatizing the system. And they also issued this study, and the word study should be put in quotes here because it was one of these, you know, where the results were in well before they started conducting their research, that showed that the Gore plan, the Gore plan for Social Security, which would have it wouldn't have been a privatization of the system, but it would have allowed you to supplement Social Security by buying stocks and bonds, but that the Gore plan was going to lead to huge budget deficits, and of course the Bush plan was going to produce paradise for investors and for the country as a whole. This was the study that this think tank put out. And Gilder, gave $151,000. Gilder gave $288,000, almost twice as much. And Schwab, who was number 73 on the 400 list, gave $393,000. In any case, though, Gilder, back to him real quickly, he's the founder of something called the Club for Growth. It's not a very well-known organization, but it's a pretty powerful one. It's a political action committee based here in Washington. And most of the members are other financiers and also some right-wing activists like the president of the National Review, Thomas Rhodes. And the Club for Growth basically interviews candidates who are thinking of running for public office who have already declared their candidacy. And if they like what they hear in one of their top positions, I mean, if you're going to be backed by the Club for Growth, you pretty much have to endorse a privatization of Social Security. They go out and they'll give you donations to your campaigns. So there were two other members of the Club for Growth, along with Gilder, who were big donors, Frank Baxter and George Spix. They gave between the two of them about $350,000. But the club backed it was 10 candidates last year with political contributions. All 10 of them won. All 10 of them were Republicans, and all 10 of them support privatizing Social Security. So that's a rather long answer to your question as to how active were the folks who want this semi-privatization. They were very active. That's the short answer, and I've already given you the long one.
As I said, we're also joined by Sarah Miles, and her book, which is out this month from Farrar, Strauss, and Drew, How to Hack a Party Line, the Democratic Party in Silicon Valley. You looked at the high-tech sector and the Mother Jones top 400 contributors. Who do you think people should be most aware of?
Well, I think there are a number of individuals who gave a lot of money, some big Bush supporters like Michael Dell of Dell Computers in Austin, Texas, and a large number of Democrats, including Steve Kirsch of InfoSeek, Mark Andreessen from the co-founder of Netscape. And there are a lot of individuals, but I think what people really should be aware of looking at the high-tech sector is not so much the amounts that these executives gave, because these executives essentially, in order to make it onto the Mother Jones list, all they had to give was about $136,000. And in the high-tech sector, that's just not very much money. And I think what people should be looking at is the vast amounts of money, completely unregulated, that this sector has been able to give to ballot initiatives, and the dawning realization by people who may not have been politically active a few years ago that they can invest even larger sums in soft money. So I think when you look at high tech, what you're seeing is a potential that's really poised to explode what we know now about campaign finances. One executive said to me, if you think there's a lot of money in politics now, just wait.
When we come back, we want to get some names like who John Doerr is and the Democrats' assembling of a brain trust of influential CEOs labeled Gore-Tex, that's T-E-C-H-S, not the material, who lent their cyber cool to then-President, Vice President Al Gore. But just who these people are. And after that, we're going to be going down to Vieques to talk about the latest decision of the Bush administration to cease, at least for now, the bombing of Vieques. We're talking to to Sarah Miles and Ken Silverstein, who both looked at different sectors and their financial contributions to the last campaign, as well as Roger Cohn, who's editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, which has put out the Mother Jones 400, revealing who bankrolled the new administration and what they expect as payback. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the top 400 contributors in the last campaign. Mother Jones' latest issue deals with the issue of who bought Bush, the Mother Jones 400 revealing who bankrolled the new administration and what they expect as payback. We're looking at the financial sector and now the high-tech sector with Sarah Miles. Sarah, we have talked to for years about her work into the far right in this country. Actually, Sarah, do you see any connections?
Well, no, actually, I think what's really interesting about high tech is for business sector, the Democrats got there first. And the Democrats got there first for a number of reasons, particularly in the Silicon Valley with a number of small startups and internet-based companies. This was a really interesting group of millionaires and multimillionaires in that they were pro-choice, pro-environment, pro-immigration, pro-gay rights, and also violently anti-union, anti-tax, anti-regulation, and pro-business. So you had people who fit a kind of Northern California image of themselves as social liberals, but also were diehard capitalists who believe fervently in keeping the federal government out of regulating their businesses. And Al Gore and Bill Clinton were actually able to garner a huge amount of support from the sector, beginning in the mid-90s, as I chronicle in my book.
So what about some quick list of names, people like Edward McVaney, Richard Egan?
Well, there, I think what you're getting back into with Bush, and it's an interesting thing, which is the splits in high tech. The Bush supporters, like C. Edward Vaney and Ken Eldred, tend to be people from larger companies. Ken Eldred, I think, is that rare thing, which is a ideological rather than a pragmatic high-tech man, the founder of a business-to-business giant called Ariba Incorporated, who essentially has a Christian right-wing agenda and says that that's why he supported George Bush. But you also look at some of the older software companies whose business comes from doing back-end work for big financial institutions and governments, and they're very tied in with the old economy, and they tend to give a lot of money to George Bush in a more traditional Republican business style.
Edward McVaney, who provided software for companies like Mobil, Chevron, Nabisco.
Right, he gave about $311,000, did a lot of work for oil companies, did a lot of work for Mobil and Chevron, as well as for a tobacco company, RJ Nabisco. And people like that, whose fortunes are really tied in with old economy businesses by providing software for them, tend to give a lot of money to the Republicans. When you look at the large Democratic donors, people like John Doerr, venture capitalist from Kleiner Perkins, who was an early Gore supporter, and who gave just under $300,000 this year to the Democrats. I think what you're seeing is people who, while they still have a very strong pro-business, pro-growth, and anti-tax attitude, don't see themselves quite as tied into traditional Republican social values.
When you started your work looking at high tech, the contributors to the Republicans and to the Democrats, were you surprised by anything you found by the end?
Well, I think the thing that, again, is the most striking to me about all of this is when we talk about the shocking amounts of money that are in play, we have to remember that we're talking about, in the world of high tech, we're essentially talking about what one executive referred to as arbitrage, which is to say the difference of the value of money in the world of tech and in the world of politics. Mark Andreessen, the co-founder of Netscape, who's a billionaire and who gave about $404,000 this year to Democrats. I talked to him last year right after he had written his big check for $250,000 to the Democratic National Committee. And Mark couldn't really understand why everybody made such a big fuss about it, because as he told me, in my business, if I only invested $250,000 in a company, people would say that I wasn't serious. We're talking about huge amounts of potential money, and people who believe that, as another young internet executive told me, politics priced today is the bargain of the century. For $10 million, you could do anything.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us. Again, the latest issue of Mother Jones has got the Mother Jones 400, revealing who bankrolled the new administration and what they expect. And by the way, Carl Lindner, for top donors, is number four. That is the banana man, as he called himself when Paula Poundstone, the comedian, if you may remember years ago, was at a Clinton fundraiser. And she said, I always wondered who stood next to the – who sat next to the president. Who are you? And he said, I am the banana man. Yes, this is the man who heads Chiquita, chair and CEO, American Financial Group, gave more than $1 million to both parties. Sarah Miles, one of the reporters who worked on this investigation, her new book out just this month will be How to Hack a Party Line, the Democratic Party in Silicon Valley. You can go to Mother Jones at motherjones.com to find out all of the other contributors in all the different sectors, from high tech to communications to manufacturing, energy, schools, etc. And in the last segment of our program, we're going down to Vieques to talk about the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's announcement ordering the Navy to suspend its bombing of Vieques, at least for the month of March. The order came 2 days after Puerto Ricans launched a new effort for an immediate and permanent end to the continued U.S. bombing of the island. In a new tactic, some 160 Puerto Ricans and supporters lobbied Congress last week, and the new Puerto Rican governor, Sila Calderon, asked Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to halt the naval exercises until he reviews a study linking the bombing to health problems among residents. We're joined right now by two people to give us some analysis of this, and does it mean an end to the bombing? Dr. Emilio Pantojas is with us, sociologist at the Center for Social Research in San Juan, and Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua, the senior political analyst for the San Juan Star. Let's start with Dr. Emilio Pantojas. The reaction in Puerto Rico and Vieques to the Bush administration's announcement.
Well, good morning. It is a reaction of cautious optimism. We've been down that road with the Clinton administration, and therefore people are optimistic. They are happy that the maneuvers were stopped for one session, but they are also very cautious because there is no long-term agreement, there is no resolution in sight, and there is there are tough negotiations ahead.
Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua, what is your understanding of why this happened? I mean, the people of Puerto Rico and Vieques have been rising up more and more over throughout the Clinton administration, yet they never got a Democratic administration to stop the bombing.
Well, I agree with Emilio that there is cautious optimism in Puerto Rico, and the people of Vieques day before yesterday threw down 500 feet of the fence of the Camp Garcia, where the Navy practices, so they have 500 feet of fence less today. And it will go on, I think, the demonstrations of civil disobedience that include, obviously, no violence, but that include the interruption of exercises by things like putting the fences down, will continue. Civil disobedience has been the only thing that has worked, and it will continue. And there is no way that this will end until the Navy leaves Vieques permanently, and that is the objective of 88% of the people of Puerto Rico, according to the latest polls in Puerto Rico.
Dr. Pantojas, what do you think now?
Well, I think that this is an uneasy truce, because short of violence or treachery, outright treachery, the Navy should not stay in Vieques. As Garcia Pasalacqua mentioned, 88% of the people polled, and there is a new consensus. Everyone thinks that the Navy should withdraw. So in order for the Navy to stay, they have to either maneuver themselves and buy some people, which they haven't been able to do, and which is very unlikely that they will succeed in doing, or simply impose their presence by force. And so the Navy is... And the defense complex are buying time to see if they can maneuver themselves into a position that where they would be able to stay in Vieques. That is untenable. That is unsustainable. People want the Navy to go. It is the first time in my lifetime. I was born in 1952. The first time since the Navy occupied Vieques where I have seen a consensus in Puerto Rico so overwhelming about anything, even about the only exception being Tito Trinidad, the boxer. So in that sense, the Navy and the Army and the defense complex is faced with the option of treachery or force, and they are buying time. It is not going to work, but they think it will.
Right now, the referendum, when do you think it will take place, Juan Manuel Garcia Basalaco?
Well, that is exactly why the Pentagon has stopped the exercises. We are again in agreement with Emilio that they can't win that referendum. So what they're trying to do at this point is stop the bombing, don't bomb before November, since the referendum is set for November 6th. Try to win the referendum by not bombing before it, and then start bombing with live fire after it. But it's ridiculous. It's totally senseless. It's typical of the military-industrial complex thinking in regards to Puerto Rico. But they will fail. They have no chance of winning that referendum. And the stopping of the exercises, as Emilio says, as a sort of truce, T-R-U-C-E, to try to appease the people of Vieques, was answered the day after their bombing stopped by the putting down of 500 feet of fence, which is continuing, I guess, every week. And the more weeks that pass, the less fence there will be. So it's useless. It's idiotic on behalf of the Pentagon.
We're talking to Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua, senior political analyst for the San Juan Star, and Dr. Emilio Pantojas, who is sociologist and senior researcher at the Center for Social Research in San Juan. Just history, you know, that the Navy for decades used live bombs in Vieques until the 1999 killing of David Sanes, who is a civilian, who was killed in one of the bombings. Protesters swept into the bombing range, occupied it for over a year until the Navy expelled them last year. People may remember in Democracy Now, as people were being arrested, we were talking to them on their cell phones as they were being moved into planes and taken away. Then the governor and President Clinton formed an agreement under which the Navy could continue training with inert bombs until a November referendum, but popular discontent has remained extremely high, and the new governor won on a platform which included the immediate ousting of the Navy. Again, analysts and activists disagree on the significance of the one-month suspension. Some hail it as the first of several victories, saying that it does mean the beginning of the end. Others call it a delay tactic to win the November referendum, which would bring the Navy back. Dr. Emilio Pantojas, do you know where the U.S. Navy would go if not Vieques? I mean, it wasn't just the Navy that used it. They rented Vieques out to be bombed by other NATO allies.
We've been talking about making an artificial island. They've been talking about a location of an island off the coast of Haiti. There seem to be other alternative islands in other parts of the North Atlantic, but they claim, and they are being adamant about that they need Vieques, which is not correct. I mean, the kind of exercises that the Navy does in Vieques, which are basically amphibious landing with air coverage, were last used during the Korean War. I mean, this is not the kinds of tactics that you use in Kosovo or in the Middle East. So it's one of those things where the Army does not want to retrench from what are basically obsolete facilities.
And you do think that this could be, though, permanent, the stopping, the ceasing of the bombing in Vieques?
Well, I think that there is a standoff here. There is a standoff between the Navy, who doesn't want to leave, and the people of Puerto Rico, who want them to leave right away. And the new administration, the Bush administration, is trying to buy time, which, you know, it's a usual tactic when you want to impose your will without imposing it through violence, through force. And so I think they will eventually have to leave. But I think it is going to be a tough negotiation. It is going to be a tough confrontation. And it is not an easy road.
I think it's interesting, Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua, that the Navy is hiring, as you've pointed out, people from Vieques to lobby for the referendum.
The Navy has announced, as a matter of fact, in one of my programs, that they have hired the brother of the dead civilian to head their effort to win the referendum, and that they have gathered a number of signatures to transfer the island of Vieques from the jurisdiction of Puerto Rico to the United States Virgin Islands as a desperate alternative not to hold the referendum that they're going to lose.
So they have hired the brother of David Sanas, who was killed by the bombing, to lead the...
Yes, just 15 minutes ago, I was listening to the rest of the family, their 14 brothers and sisters, saying that this is the only brother that supports the Navy, that the rest of the family stands by their dead brother. So they have even attempted to split an honorable family of people in Vieques to get their way, and it has backfired like you never saw. I mean, the announcement by Jeff Gordon, the spokesman for the Navy, that called all radio stations to permit David Sanes' brother to make his statement of adherence to the Navy by being paid for by the Navy and accepting that publicly has resulted in an enormous backlash because, as Emilio also said, the people of Vieques are not going to be bought off. This is national pride here at play, and they will prevail. The Navy will get out of Vieques. You can bet on that.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Juan Manuel Garcia Basalacqua and Dr. Emilia Pantojas. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fired, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.